Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Ken Salatz, Director, Global Policy Information Technology Industry Council, or ITI. Ken, thank you for sharing so many of your deep experiences with our audience.
Sure, my pleasure.
Now, can you describe your journey from when you were very young to your 20s and the milestones and lessons that continue to shape your vision, goals, and execution style?
Well, that's quite a range. Basically, just grew up in Southern California, essentially middle-class upbringing. We had stable neighborhoods, so we didn't move around at all. So grew up with the same set of friends in the neighborhood and the like, and absorbed a lot of lessons from my folks, one being, you know, pay your own way, basically stand on your own feet, and you know, if you make mistakes, then own up to them, so to speak. As fairly young, I was intrigued by the U.S. political landscape, surprisingly, getting involved in some of the tax issues and debates that were taking place in the local community in Orange County, but also fascinated by geopolitical dynamics, which led to a desire to get involved in international relations and the like as I, you know, grew up, got older, and visited other countries. In school, dabbled in psychology, almost became a school teacher, elementary school teacher, and was also involved in financial planning, but ultimately I found a way to take my various political experiences and campaigns and the like and turn that into a ticket to Washington, D.C. And I've been in D.C. since 85.
You know, it's a fascinating journey that you've been on. You know, prior to joining ITI, can you describe some sort of key lessons that you learned while serving on the professional staff of a U.S. House of Representatives?
Sure. I had an early opportunity to jump from personal staff to professional staff on one of the House committees in the House of Representatives. Technically, my title was staff investigator, though I was just called a professional staff member. But by virtue of that, I was able to probably dive deeper into a set of issues than I otherwise might have had I stayed on the congressman's staff. So I covered things like the Wilberg mine disaster in Utah, where 29 coal miners lost their lives. I was involved in congressional investigations on aviation security after the Pan Am 103 bombing over Lockerbie, Scotland. And then also had a chance to look at a set of issues where major corporations, in this case an airline, would go into a small market and use their market power basically to try to push just your average individuals out of their careers, essentially, in the travel business. And so we weighed in that regard. What I learned, I think, from that process was that Congress as an institution was sort of a great equalizer. It enabled average everyday individuals such as myself to stand up to the U.S. government or to major corporations and give us more kind of a level, you know, the cliche level playing field. So I thought that was always important, and that kind of gave me an appreciation for more of approaching issues, significant issues, from the individual perspective, from trying to find ways to equalize the power structure. And, you know, it was an interesting experience in that regard. I also learned fairly early on that, you know, high-level officials usually know a lot about a little and a little about a lot. And as a consequence, they had to rely on and surround themselves with smart people with common sense. I tried to become one of those people in that process. But again, I understood that even people that seemingly have significant influence often are somewhat little or limited in many respects. They're no different than me. So that was something I think hopefully have carried with me going into my career at ITI and beyond.
Again, just a remarkable background, remarkable experiences, and I can see how that would shape you and all of your execution going forward. Now, you mentioned ITI. I mean, how did you get involved in ITI, and what do you see as the value proposition of ITI?
I joined ITI straight from the Hill meaning Congress. I was involved in a committee that had a significant impact on federal procurement policy. And at that time, the tech industry was evolving basically from electric typewriters to the computer age, so to speak, you know, the digital world. And Congress had a significantly potential impact on shaping that market and that transition. And one of the key desires that industry had was that we be able to sell our products and services to all customers, essentially treating them the same way. Now, granted, obviously the U.S. government's a major purchaser of you know, technology and services, but the notion was that the, in terms of the market and innovation and the like, the policies were essentially the same. And so our goal was to try to treat the government like a commercial customer and encourage the government to adopt commercial practices, basically. So I was hired by ITI to work on kind of the industry side of that equation. And in the first few years, we were, I think, instrumental in helping Congress pass two significant procurement reforms that truly changed the way that the federal government bought ICT. The value proposition for ITI, I think it's our ability to translate the complex and often arcane views and technology of our collective membership into plain language that can be understood and leveraged by policymakers in global markets. We have people highly skilled in coalescing the many voices into one and then amplifying industry perspectives and capitals around the world.
So who would be the members of ITI?
ITI's membership is varied. We have roughly 60 companies. I say roughly because the industry is almost like beating a heart in a way, and sometimes it expands and contracts depending on what's happening in the marketplace. But we represent everything from the chip makers like AMD and Intel all the way up through virtual companies like VeriSign and almost everything in between. Our membership is, we draw from Europe, Asia, obviously North America. We have now a member company from India, which is, you know, our kind of a new expansion into that market. And we're also beginning to talk to tech companies, in many cases startups, in the global south, Africa, Latin America, and Asia. So we're evolving as an organization. This is our 100th anniversary. And people often ask me, well, were there computers 100 years ago? And I say, well, no, not. You know, essentially no, but there were business machines, and two of our original members, the precursor to IBM and the National Cash Register Company, NCR, are still in ITI, you know, 100 years later. So we've done something right, and we appreciate the confidence that the companies invest in us.
No, I'm just thinking, are you similar to TechNet or different?
We're different in the sense that we're almost more of working level. I mean, I think the companies bring people to our tables that not only have policy skills, but also technical skills. And we project ourselves globally. I mean, clearly the ICT industry is a global industry with global suppliers and global markets. And one of the key roles, I mean, I am on the global policy team. So we are actively engaged in basically traveling to various capitals to have direct engagement with not only the policymakers, but also industry, academia, and NGOs. TechNet, I think, is a bit more focused on you know, in the U.S. itself and with the U.S. government.
You know, again, that's sort of fascinating. Just kind of remarkable what you've achieved. And you, like you said, 100 years, that's another milestone. What are some of the goals for ITI for this year and next year?
I mean, one of our goals always is to promote market access. So free trade, open markets, the free exchange of information and ideas between economies. That's essentially the fuel of our industry, is to try to tap into as many ideas and individuals and innovators in different markets, but also to be able to take our technology and sell it into those markets, whether it's service, hardware, or what have you. So ultimately, I think we really engage in encouraging the adoption of policies that we believe will promote free trade and the free flow of information in whatever form, whether it's data, communications, you know, human communication, whatever the case may be. So almost everything we do, whether it's what we do walking the halls of Congress or walking the halls of the European Commission, it's essentially the core basis of that is to promote sound policy and innovation.
You know, it sounds like what you're trying to do would tie in very well with the International Telecommunications Union, or ITU, this UN agency responsible for ICT. Do you work with them at all?
Yeah, actually, in the past few years, I've spent more time engaging the ITU, usually as a member of a U.S. delegation, for example, to the ITU Plenipot that was in Busan in 2014. I've attended a few other activities. I've been to the WISIS Forum a few times, in fact, where we met. ITU is an interesting institution for our industry. You know, to their credit, they went from, what, telegraph to landline communications, telecommunications, and now they are endeavoring to expand more actively into the ICT realm. They are very, very good at some things, for example, attracting a crowd. It's clearly a locus of activity for a number of governments globally, particularly from the developing world. But they also create challenges for us in that as we invest in, for example, ICT standardization and various development activities, typically we don't go to the ITU to do that work, but rather we go to voluntary industry-led standards development venues where we think we get a better return on the investment. So in dealing with ITU, we have respect for the institution. I have friends that are in the leadership at the ITU, and I very much enjoy those friendships. But it's a balancing act, and it's one that we probably will continue to play out, or will continue to play out for the next few years.
You know, one of the things I'm doing right now is I'm the chair of the Technology Advisory Council for the Financial Services Roundtable, which is a Washington, D.C.-based, I would say, trade organization representing approximately 100 CEOs in the biggest financial services companies in the U.S. And I know that they're actively working with technology companies and things like that. I'm just thinking, do you do any work with FSR, the Financial Services Roundtable, at all?
No. And we have a few members that are engaged in that industry, Visa, for example. But in terms of active engagement with that particular organization or that sector, not yet. That could happen perhaps, you know, in the near term, because our model, our business model, well, I should say our members' business models keep evolving, and as they do, we do as well. But as of now, it's not an active engagement.
Now, you know, you've got this a great position, and it's global, it has impact. Can you describe in more detail your role and then what you hope to achieve?
My role within ITI, you know, the title Director of Global Policy, which is fairly generic, we actually have multiple directors of global policy. We all tend to focus on different, I mean, the focus may be on a particular policy. For example, my portfolio includes ICT standardization, ICT accessibility, making technology accessible for people with disabilities. And then also I'm moving more into sustainable development. That started off as an internet governance focus, but clearly when we're talking about internet governance, that covers an array of issues that touch on our industry and touch on our customers. So we are now looking more at a sustainable development engagement. But in terms of, you know, goals, I have a short-term goal for 2016, for example. I've helped launch an initiative called Connect the Unconnected. And it's a broadband initiative, which is obviously not unique because there are an array of broadband initiatives and some very good work being done globally in that area. But one thing we're trying to do a little different is really focus on peer leadership. So rather than have like the U.S. or even the industrialized countries sit down with you know, government officials, industry, and the like from the developing world, we want to really emphasize what is happening in the developing world, what is working in, you know, for governments, for NGOs, for the business community, that can then possibly be a solid example for other countries that are in a, you know, similar situation with similar aspirations. So by the end of this year, we're going to be publishing what we're calling a policy toolkit or toolbox, with the notion that one size doesn't fit all. So if you have an array of options that might help other countries that, again, have similar aspirations, be able to make decisions that could help accelerate their progress in building out their digital economies. So by the end of the year, again, I hope to be able to publish that toolbox in December and then have commitments from a handful of select countries to facilitate the engagement with the next round and expand that process into 2017. To me, that's an exciting project and goal because it really takes the emphasis and the focus away from what's important for our industry and places it on what's important for governments, businesses, and individual citizens in these countries.
You know, I just got back from speaking in Africa for a conference called Digital Africa, and they're leveraging technology to try to transform in some ways help the whole economy of Africa. It sounds like that would be a good fit for your organization as well. So I'm thinking I'll describe in more detail just the work that you're doing. And I guess one of those areas, and you've already mentioned this, is ICT accessibility. Can you talk about some of the issues around that?
Yeah, accessibility is a fascinating issue because, you know, again, with our industry, one of the goals is to be able to expand the effective use of technology, the internet and everything that goes with it, to as many people as possible. For our industry, I think if you look, for example, in the United States, government is probably the largest employer of people with disabilities, but I believe the second largest employer is the tech industry, because we need people with skills, ideas, and the ambition to really engage and help us innovate. And one of the advantages of technology is you can basically participate in that activity anywhere you are. And for some people, they literally cannot leave their homes, but through technology, they can actively engage not only in the, you know, their work environment, but also in society broadly. So that's been something that is particularly, something I've enjoyed. But one thing from a policy perspective, we're really looking at technical solutions. And in engaging governments, we often find that they believe that their particular market or city or whatever, you know, the jurisdiction may be, is unique. And by virtue of being unique, that they need to have their own set of rules or a different set of rules rather than looking at what's available globally that they could leverage, you know, that's already in the marketplace. But in our experience, I like to say if you're a blind individual in Brussels, Brisbane, or the Bronx, in effect, the technical solution is essentially the same. There'll be variations for language, maybe some cultural considerations, but the fundamental technology that can help individuals with the visual disabilities is essentially the same. So when we go out and advocate to governments on how to address accessibility policy, we really try to promote essentially a harmonized approach, not necessarily a harmonized set of standards or rules per se, but a core approach that rather than prescribing what we have to do as a solution, they essentially identify the outcomes, the performances that they're endeavoring to accomplish, and then allow industry to innovate and compete to provide the best solution. We find that when that does happen, ultimately the customer benefits because they get usually a broader range of choices at lower prices, and that's essentially what everybody desires.
So, you know, you've talked about this somewhat in the prior questions, but what are the challenges then for standardization policy?
One of the challenges is what I like to call the roadmap and trying to get people, you know, the policymakers to choose what we might say is the most effective roadmap. We are actively dealing with governments in Asia and in Europe, the European Commission right now on standards policy. Europe has the Digital Single Market Initiative underway where they are trying to really promote and focus on expanding, you know, technical development in Europe itself. But we have the same conversation whether we're talking with somebody from Uganda or Thailand or wherever. And then the notion is that the tech industry as it exists today and the technology that they enjoy, usually, I mean, literally everybody has something in their pocket or in their briefcase or in their home. Essentially, the way we have achieved this incredible innovation and development in the digital sector has been, you know, that activity has been fueled to a large extent by voluntary industry-led standards. And we think that that is the best way to go. It tends to be fairly rapid in development. It moves essentially at the speed of innovation. And the outcomes, while they may be diverse and varied, that's, we think, a benefit of that process because it provides businesses with a choice on which standards to adopt and adapt into their own structure and deliver solutions to the customer. One of the key challenges we're running into is that as more and more governments start to sort of reinvent their processes to build out their own, you know, digital infrastructure, that they tend to want to adopt rules or set priorities from a political perspective rather than from a technical perspective. And in the course of doing that, you run into a number of challenges. One is there might be standards adopted that tend to benefit legacy providers, or maybe that emphasize one particular architecture like telecom over IT or some other, you know, possibility. And so we are, again, globally active. We have a standardization policy committee that I manage that engages governments around the world in promoting voluntary industry standards development and encouraging governments to bring their ideas, their requirements, et cetera, and engage in those processes to participate and sit at the table and thereby benefit everybody by virtue of gaining a better understanding of their perception of, you know, their needs for their marketplace. It just, when we run into situations where we have run into prescriptions, so to speak, rather than the solution side of things, I think that innovation tends to stop. I mean, with tech companies, it's not quite this way as much as it used to be, but if, let me take an example of energy efficiency, which is an issue I used to manage. If a government came in and said, this is exactly how you will do it, this is what you'll do to achieve energy efficiency, then the businesses tend to say, okay, there's the mandate, the requirement, and we will do exactly that. But in the process of doing exactly that, innovation stops. In some respects, competition ends because everybody's doing the same thing. But if governments, policymakers, even, you know, corporations that are seeking to purchase technology would define their needs and what they hope to acquire rather than setting a very specific bar, you encourage companies to basically jump higher. And by virtue of that, coming up with better solutions and, you know, ultimately through competition, probably accelerating the you know, price drops for the technology that does enter the marketplace. So that's part of the challenge. And it's similar to, you know, other issues that we manage within ITI. But in this particular case, it's a bit more technical. And I benefit from having a committee that has company membership that include, you know, the leaders of standards development within, you know, major ICT corporations.
You know, you were at ITU with this, you're integrated within sort of these different UN programs. The UN last year voted to support these new sustainable development goals from 2015 onwards to 2030. And that's a big part of what you do. So how can sustainable development be achieved?
I mean, we don't have to convince people for the most part that technology plays a key role. I think there's a broader and broader acceptance of that fact, or recognition, if you will. And in fact, in some cases, you have UN agencies seemingly skirmishing over which particular institution is going to own that policy basket, so to speak, within the UN structure. I think what we need to do is take that acceptance, that ambition, and find practical ways to change that, you know, or inject it, so to speak, into the marketplace. There, technology has advanced so quickly that in some cases, I mean, clearly we talk about the digital divide, you know, and it's, the UN talks about that, the World Bank, everybody uses that phrase. It means different things in different scenarios. A digital divide might be, for example, between the technical or infrastructure capabilities of two countries. It might be differences within the country, with a single country, between provinces, states, or even cities. Or it might be between, you know, the classes, the so-called elite that have the ability, the capital to invest in technology and develop the skills, versus those that don't have that ability or the flexibility within their daily lives to buy what some might perceive to be a luxury item as opposed to a necessity for advancing, you know, education and business and other opportunities. But we also find that in some cases it's generational. And that's one of the challenges I think we run into with sustainable development and dealing with emerging economies. I had a gentleman in Africa who works in a government explain to me one of the the frustrations he had in trying to advance broadband, for example, and the adoption and the utilization of broadband. And he commented, he said, you need to appreciate that for my minister, just the notion of holding a wireless telephone in his hand is so revolutionary in his life that he's perfectly satisfied with basically having the device solely be used for conversation. And I'd never quite thought of it that way because, you know, we're looking at smartphones and tablets and all of these other technologies that, that are already on our desks, in our hands, and then looking at the next generation coming over the horizon. But for some individuals that perhaps, you know, were born, raised not only in different generations but different circumstances, some of the technology they already have is just overwhelming in terms of its capability versus the previous environment that they, you know, either grew up in or perhaps had businesses and the like. So one of the challenges in sustainable development is helping the decision makers within those markets, whether it's in government or industry or even in academia, understand that there are these tools and these capabilities readily available, typically at various price points, but becoming, you know, less and less expensive, that they can employ within their businesses, within their economies, within their societies, that could really help advance economic development and just social development in so many ways. So how do we respond to that? You do it through gentle conversation, encouragement, and sharing information, but you also do it through listening to really try to understand the perspective and, you know, from where the individual is coming from, what their experience is and how they perceive what technology is and what it can do. And then from their experience in their place, try to help them understand the opportunities. So for ITI as an organization representing 60, you know, global ICT companies, some of the, I like to say the Fortune 100, you know, global ICT companies, our role in many cases is to go into these markets where many of our companies are already actively engaged, but go in and build those relationships and help leverage the technology and skills and in some cases the goodwill of our industry and find ways to employ that and break down barriers that may exist or help dissolve those barriers so that there is a better connection and a mutual benefit between the industry and the individuals on the other end of the transaction.
Ken, there's an interest in the Global South and an increasing emphasis. Can you talk more about that?
The Global South traditionally has been a set of markets that we didn't really focus on initially as an industry. So it's we've gone through an evolutionary process, which in any industry goes through, but in the case of ICT, I think the kind of the usual suspects, you know, the Europe and Japan, Korea, and now China, those evolving India, there have been logical places where you had infrastructure investment already in place, certain types of infrastructure you could leverage. You had education systems, you had business environments, tax environments, you had the basic tools to go in and utilize and benefit from that development to expand your business. In the Global South, again, meaning Africa, Latin America, and Southeast Asia, you have many very successful economies, very liberal economies, where they are already utilizing technology to a significant extent. But as we know, there are many other countries that have not had those opportunities or are coming out of an environment where perhaps the risk was too high to engage in that particular economy. But now the seeds have been sown for expanding or a desire to expand and engage in the global digital economy. Part of that spurred on by the ITU, for example, and some of the educational processes and information that they share. But looking at other institutions, you know, the UN, you've got the World Bank, you have the Internet Society, you know, as an NGO, you have all of these different organizations providing input and basically creating a more receptive environment for technology to come in and to put our stamp, so to speak, into those markets to help them utilize our tools and to use their ideas and hire their people and the like. So the Global South is really ripe for a more direct engagement, particularly by ITI. And our industry, you know, writ large. So that's the role that we're endeavoring to play. I was in Zimbabwe attending an African Telecommunication Union meeting a couple of years ago, I think it was 2014, and that was the first time anybody from our organization had ever been in sub-Saharan Africa. And I'm not saying our companies, but ITI as a, you know, a nonprofit industry group. And now I'm going to be in Kenya, Nairobi, Kenya, in a couple of weeks attending the UNCTAD conference down there, and then setting up meetings again with the ministers, industry, and particularly with the Kenyan government to advance this dialogue on, for one thing, our connecting the unconnected initiative, but also expanding policy engagements. So we also have on staff an expert from that focuses on Latin America. She speaks Spanish fluently. She's actually learning Portuguese to be more effective in Brazil. But we have, in fact, she and our senior vice president just returned from a week and a half tour of, I think it was Argentina and Brazil, Colombia and Chile. And then right now I have another colleague who is on a tour of Korea, Japan, and China. So we are moving further into markets in the south, Thailand, Malaysia, other countries, the Philippines, et cetera, to engage their industries, engage their governments on a global dialogue and bring them into, you know, the global conversation that we've long enjoyed with industry groups from Europe, Asia, you know, Japan and Australia and the like. And one thing that is pure enjoyment, really, is to go into these markets to talk to the tech businesses, often startups, but in some cases established businesses, and play, in effect, a mentoring role. They look at ITI and they say, you know, you've got these brand name ICT companies. You've been around for a long time. How do you do it? And we've even had governments approach us and say, we would really appreciate you coming into our country and working with our tech industry, you know, the nascent tech industry, and help them become more effective partners with government in expanding, you know, our own digital economies. And that's something I think that we can uniquely provide that most other organizations or entities, you know, whether it's an NGO or the like, they don't have that particular set of skills. So that's one avenue that we're looking at, you know, an opportunity, I should say, to expand into the global south and build those relationships.
You know, it's kind of fascinating. Do you in some way try to work with this sort of mobile payment technology, M-Pesa, or do you work with the Gates Foundation in terms of all the work they're doing in the global south?
We've had contact with the Gates Foundation. We're definitely looking at M-Pesa. We're going to feature that most likely in our broadband initiative. That's part of the conversation with Kenya because of the excellent experience they've had. The Gates Foundation tends to be more tightly focused than we are. And while we're not, certainly don't want to be overly broad because we would spread ourselves too thin, we are looking at a number of different areas that, you know, include the Gates Foundation focus, but frankly, other foundations as well as NGOs and our businesses. So we're still kind of in the beginning process of the connecting initiative. And we have actually the second session coming up on October 6th, where actually second and third sessions we'll be having receiving reports directly from countries about their experiences, lessons learned and the like. Also businesses and some of the multilateral financial institutions. And then from there, we will develop that report. But we're hoping by engaging directly with governments, with the NGOs, with business community and the financial community, that we can create this kind of dynamic policy toolbox that will help all of those entities become more effective in collaborating, for one thing, but also engaging and addressing some of the challenges in their marketplaces.
So we're going to sort of change the direction of the interview in the last few questions. You have many interests. Can you talk further about them?
You mean personally?
Yeah, or things outside of the ITI.
Well, I mean, personally, music is an essential part of my life. I play guitar and many other instruments. I probably own too many instruments. If you went into my basement, you would be stumbling over them. But I've always loved music since I was a small child, and I write songs, I perform and on occasion. And almost everywhere I travel, I have a tendency to find live music and to meet the musicians and you know, build relationships with these individuals with all types of music. So to me, music is like a universal language. No matter where I go, I find it, and I find that I have an instant rapport with the people that are making music. So that's definitely kind of a stabilizer in my life, so to speak. Lately, one of my key interests is my first granddaughter. She turns, in fact, 5 months old today, and it's like being handed an opportunity for a blank canvas, so to speak. But I'm not the one painting it. She is. But to sit there and observe that and frankly, to observe her reaction to technology is just, it's fascinating because she's literally born into a world well beyond anything that I experienced at a similar point. So it's just really been fun watching how she responds and responding to her. Beyond that, international politics remains something I'm very interested in. I mean, among many of my friends, they don't talk about Brexit, for example, whereas for me, it's, you know, I find it fascinating. You know, I love to speculate on what it means, what will happen, listen to other individuals, so-called experts, speculate, but also go and talk to the actual people who made the decision, who you know, marked the ballot or whatever to make that change and find out what motivates them and, you know, what are their aspirations. Because I think ultimately those are the people that I really relate to, and those are the people that I, you know, see our industry trying to address. So I just have an affinity for folks that, you know, the common folk, basically, because I'm one of them. Other than that, I read a lot, array of things. I am very interested in just the kind of the global dynamic of, but also trying to contemplate, you know, my place in it and what, how I can possibly contribute something somewhere. So I just enjoy life generally and love to travel. Going back to Ireland for a holiday next month with my wife, touring the West Coast, finding all the great music pubs and just, you know, contemplating where I want to settle down. And, you know, my horizon is broader than just the United States.
Well, Ken, this is our last question, and it wraps up some of the things you talked about, the fact that you're speaking extensively around the world, you travel extensively, you have some really interesting work, both in your history and currently. You know, do you have any interesting stories to share? Maybe something really amusing or surprising, unexpected, amazing?
I've been blessed, you know, in life with a good career, good opportunities, a good upbringing. And all of that has coalesced into opportunities to, you know, meet people and engage on a global basis and to try to find ways to make a contribution. So some of my favorite stories, one, for example, talking to a mid-level bureaucrat in a telecom agency in Africa, very frank conversation. I was talking about the industry perspective and he was talking about the government perspective. And he turned to me and he looked me in the eye and he said, do you know the problem with Americans? And I chuckled and I said, well, I can think of many problems, but you tell me what do you see as a problem? He says, you listen with your mouths. You know, and I laughed out loud and I instantly understood what he meant. And that was an important lesson for me to learn, that in the process of trying to engage, that you really have to listen and appreciate and endeavor to understand the worldview, the community view, the individual view of, you know, the folks you're talking to and you're working with and collaborating. Because if we go in with an American perspective or an ICT industry perspective or a Ken Solette's perspective, and that's the sole basis of how I understand things or perceive things, then I'm going to miss so much. And I really can't be very effective as a collaborator with whether it's an individual or a business or a government. So that one lesson right there has reverberated in all of my work, and I still am grateful to the young gentleman that, you know, was bold enough to make that statement. Another thing I learned is that people of seemingly great importance are no more than my own kind. That's a line from a poem I wrote when I was 16. That as important as somebody may seem or their position may seem, ultimately they're still just individuals trying to, you know, they more or less have the same same interests, the same desires, and the same aspirations in life. And I learned that at the table of women, wives whose husbands were steel workers who were being shut out, locked out from a steel plant. And that motivated me as then a congressional investigator to delve deeper into that situation, only to find out that for that particular plant, steel plant, that the company and the union, the steelworkers union, had cut a deal to shut down that plant in favor of keeping the plant open in another part of the country. And to see how those individuals were being used by both the union and the company actually stirred considerable anger. And I was able to get a hold of contracts and other things and expose that situation. And by virtue of doing that, through a member of Congress, you know, I was just a staff person, but by virtue of that work, the steel plant, the steel company was compelled to sell the facility. New buyers came in. They modernized a lot of the productivity and the equipment. The unions, you know, under pressure, gave back some of the requirements or rules. They relaxed some of the rules that enabled that facility to become more profitable. And it survived another 10 to 12 years. And, you know, who knows how many lives that benefited in terms of that process. So that, you know, if I look back at my entire career, that might be one of my most favorite experiences. And then last one, more an embarrassment, but I still laugh at it. I was actually in Germany in 1989, initially in Bonn. I was in Berlin in May of 89. And like many people in my generation, I never ever expected to see the Berlin Wall come down. But it was just a fascinating time. And again, I love to put myself in the middle of that. As you might recall, there were people literally climbing the walls into the embassy, the West German embassy compound. And, you know, there were people crossing borders from from East Germany to the Czech Republic, et cetera. And I was smack in the middle of that and just absorbing. It was like being on a movie set. But coming on the bus from West or East Berlin, crossing back into West Berlin, when you went through Checkpoint Charlie, there was a sign that said no photography, and it was in plain English. And being kind of an arrogant young whippersnapper, I thought we had crossed the border, so I whipped out my camera to take a photo. And the German border guard, East German border guard, immediately stopped the bus. And the bus was a delegation of congressional staff and lawyers and the like, that were being hosted by a program called Haus Glissen, based in Hamburg. And apparently it was a border guard colonel came onto the bus and pointed at me, sitting in the back of the bus. And our probably a chaperone, it was a good word for it, was an Air Force colonel, U.S. Air Force colonel. And he walked back and he said he wants you to go with him. And everybody was, you know, kind of freaking out a little bit. And here I was being walked off the bus and stood right next to the bus, and this border guard colonel was screaming at me, almost, you know, like a few inches from nose to nose, with saliva flowing and everything else. I mean, he was making sure it was as uncomfortable as possible for me. And knowing a little bit of German, I understood some of the terminology he was using, and I won't repeat it for this interview. But I just kept on saying in German, I'm sorry, I thought I was across the border. But standing behind him was a female border guard, and she looked at me as the colonel was screaming at me, and she winked at me. And I remember from that moment on, it was like a wave of relaxation just, you know, swept over me. Okay, yes, you screwed up. You're in this precarious situation, but this is a show, and you need to just go along with it, and then everything will be fine. And ultimately, it was. You know, I got walked back onto the bus. Our Air Force chaperone was livid, as you can imagine. But for whatever reason, I felt like I had just had another one of those little moments in life that you'll never forget, and that definitely leaves an imprint on you. And I probably was fortunate that we were at the tail end of the East German regime. It could have been worse. And, you know, that's, again, that's part of what my career, both working for Congress and for ITI, has created those opportunities or enabled me to get involved in these instances. But whether I'm standing in Tiananmen Square in Beijing or I'm, you know, crossing from East Germany into West Germany, whatever the case is, it's just a really had a, you know, a great life in that respect, and I very much appreciate all the opportunities that have been given me.
You know, those are just fascinating stories, and quite interesting, and at times put a smile on my face, especially sort of listening with your mouth. It's just thank you for taking the time and just sharing so much of your wisdom and experiences with your, you know, with our audience, I should say. You know, we are indeed fortunate you came in to do the interview. And again, we really appreciate just everything that you shared in terms of what you have done in the past, what you're doing today, and what you plan to do in the future.
It's been my pleasure, Steve. I appreciate the opportunity.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Ken Sulitz, Director of Global Policy, the Information Technology Industry Council.